What is the worst that could happen as we tell people about Jesus? What is the worst that could happen? Perhaps you might even want to say, what is the worst that has already happened? What has been your experience? What, for example, is the most hurtful rejection that you have had? Let me give you one example in my own life. Years ago, many years ago now, I worked as an auditor in a large accounting firm in London. One of the partners there, a Christian man, worked with me to get a regular room booking in our offices to have a weekly meeting for any Christian that wanted to get together and to read the Bible and to pray for the conversion of others in our workplace. He was also good enough to send out an invitation to that event on the internal email system. It's great when you're a partner, you get to do those things. Within 2 hours of that email going out, there was another one posted on the internal message boards inviting people to a devil's club. Same time, same day. It was deliberately designed to mock me. I know the guys who did it. It was designed to mock me, and it did the job. I wonder what your experience is. It is so easy, isn't it, to lose heart. Do you notice that Paul bookends this whole passage by saying, so we do not lose heart. And yet our immediate instinct is to say, no, Paul, I lose heart all the time. So if we do that, what keeps us going? What is it that is going to keep us telling people about Jesus? What is it, if I can be so bold, that will actually start some of us off telling people about Jesus? Because look, I am sure there are many of us here today who have not even begun. We haven't even started because we know what it will be like. We know we will be rejected. We know that people will mock us and worse. We want to be liked and we want to keep our place in the world. And so it is so easy, isn't it, to stay silent. So what will open our mouths? Well, says Paul, what opens our mouths is the message itself. It is the ministry itself. It is telling people about Jesus itself that actually motivates us. See what he says here. Look at verse 1 with me, friends. Therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Now, of course, this follows straight on from what we read last week. The ministry that Paul is writing about here is what in chapter 3 he calls a glorious ministry of the Spirit. A ministry, he tells us, that is far greater than Moses' spectacular ministry on Mount Sinai. It is a ministry, of course, that brings people back to the God who made them, that brings life itself. And Paul reminds us, we have this ministry by God's mercy. Therefore, although it feels otherwise, it is not meant to be a burden to us. It is a gift. Do you ever think about what it would mean to tell other people about Jesus and then you actually feel your shoulders almost dropping at the weight of it? You feel your chest constricting. You know that many people will not want it, even though you know at the same time how important it is that they hear. Does that not make you want to lose heart? Well, no, says Paul. Not if you understand it properly. If we understand it properly, it changes the way we go about things because let's face it, we are always so tempted to change things, just not in the right way. Look, who can blame us? If the gospel is by its nature the aroma of death to some, then it is so very tempting, isn't it, to change the way that we present it. And again, that is understandable. Look, even at lunch yesterday, I had a great conversation with someone about Jesus. But then they asked me the killer question, what do you think about hell? Do you believe in that stuff about fire and judgment and punishment? And you know what happens at that moment. I know the truth. I know what Jesus says. But what will I say? Because in the back of my mind, there is a little voice that is shouting, if you tell the truth on this one, they will run a mile. Have you been there? I'm sure you have. What do you think about hell? What do you think about other religions? What do you think about marriage? What about the gay thing? You know what it's like. I lose heart. And all too quickly, I become like the worst used car salesman. Now, no disrespect. If you're a used car salesman here, let me shake you by the hand afterwards. As long as that's not committing me to anything. But do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? If the customer sees that maybe not quite so kosher air conditioning unit, he's going to walk. And so I'm going to do everything to steer him away. So I flannel about and I avoid the hard stuff. I cut the price maybe to sell more goods. It is always my temptation as I lose heart to avoid the hard stuff. But no, says Paul, when we understand the glorious ministry of the gospel, we don't do that anymore. We don't try and trick people with a bait and switch. you know, tell them one thing now and another thing later, or impress them with a clever answer. No, verse 2, he says, we renounce that. We don't deceive, and we certainly don't distort the word of God. Instead, we set the truth forth plainly. And Paul tells us this commends us both to those we are speaking to and to God himself. Now, that feels strange to us. Instinctively, we go, no, no, David, if I give it straight, I will not be commending myself to other people. But I actually want to suggest we are in a unique position here in Australia, because this is not such a difficult thing in our Australian culture. Australia, friends, is a country that actually prizes people who are straightforward. We think it is a virtue. And I've got to tell you, and I mean this sincerely, my experience in ministry is that those that I speak to will often appreciate it when I speak plainly. And I say to them, look, I know this might not sound comfortable, but I want to tell you the way it is. Not disrespectfully, not rudely, but setting things out plainly. We ought to be encouraged by that here in Australia. It's better than we think it is in that regard. But again, a little voice in my head says, oh no, I need to soften it. I need to package it up. No, says Paul, because that is to misunderstand how the whole thing works. And it also misunderstands what people are like. Because, friends, people are blind. This is the point of the next few verses, verses 3 to 6. People are blind. It's not just that the world out there does not want to know or it can't see clearly. Actually, there is a total blindness. So we might think that our message is difficult, that it is somehow obscured. But to a blind man, friends, it makes no difference whether the glasses you give him are blurry or give him 20/20 vision. He's still blind. So our gospel may be veiled, verses 3 and 4, but it is veiled to those who are perishing because they're blind. Now, the veil language here, of course, is referenced to last week and that veil that Moses put on his face when he came down from Mount Sinai. Paul tells us that symbolizes a heart that is hardened to the gospel, not least amongst the Jews, but also to others. And it symbolizes people who do not want to hear the gospel because of the nature of the message. So look, what is the point that he's making? Well, it's as simple as this. We worry that somehow if we tell the gospel straight, some aspects of it will turn people away. And we have to kind of compensate for it. It is veiled, right? And we worry about that. But, says Paul, don't worry about it. They're dead. They're blind. And if people are dead, you cannot make them more dead. Friends, you cannot do more harm to someone's spiritual state by telling them the gospel straight. Do you see that? If it's veiled to those who are perishing. If someone is totally blind, it does not matter what color you paint the gospel in. They still can't see it. They're totally unable, he says, verse 4, to see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ. You could set the firework display off in front of them that would make Disney think they were inadequate. They would still not see it. It would make no difference. If you're blind, you're blind. And so we do not need to put a pretty color on it, or at least what we think is a pretty color. Now, at this point, there is an obvious question, isn't there? You go, well, David, if people are blind, and Paul clearly says so here, so it's true, how will they see again? If their minds are veiled, and if they are perishing, and if nothing I can do actually really makes any worse, because they're already as far gone as they can be, then what hope is there? Well, says Paul, it's all down to God. We set forth the truth plainly, and in the language of verse 5, that is, we simply preach Christ. We do that because it is God who is actually the one who saves people. And so we leave that to him. You see, the reason that we so often fudge the message, the reason we distort it, is that we think it's actually down to how well we do a job, right? How well we explain things and how well we persuade people. But it is not. If someone is blind, again, it doesn't matter how pretty the picture that you paint, they cannot see it. Instead, it is God's work. And it is an amazing work. Look at verse 6 with me. If you look at no other verse today, look at verse 6 with me. If we get our head around verse 6, it completely changes how we go about telling people about Jesus. It blasts away any chance we have that we would lose heart. It encourages us to keep telling people about Jesus, even though we see many reject it. Now, what does verse 6 say? Well, read it with me. Verse 6. For God who said, quote, let light shine out of darkness, made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. Now, think about that for a moment. When and where did God say, let light shine out of darkness? Well, it's not an exact quote in the Bible, but the reference, I think, is quite clear. It is the very first day of creation, isn't it? Genesis 1, verse 3, everything is dark, and God says, just by his word, let there be light. And light appears, just by a spoken word. And in the same way, Paul shows us, that is how we became a Christian. Our blind hearts were pitch black, and yet it was God who turned the light on. And with our blindness eradicated, we could see freely. And what is it that we saw? Well, we saw, he says, God's glory, that is how awesome God is, displayed in the face of Christ. That is to say, we saw who Jesus really is. How wonderful he really is. Could have been we'd heard about him for years, but our hearts were black as midnight until God switched the light on. That was my story. I grew up in church. I knew so many Bible stories about Jesus. I knew my prayer book pretty well as well. But at the age of 19, God made his light shine in my heart, and then, only then, did I see who Jesus really was. I wonder what your story is. Here's the thing, maybe at morning tea, tell somebody else what was the moment when God switched the light on in your heart. Now remember the point of all this. Paul wants us to be encouraged. The encouragement here is that ultimately conversion is God's work. And if it is God's work, then I do not need to be the one that tries to make it happen. That means I don't need to try to use sophisticated techniques. I don't need to find the next clever way to try and present the gospel. No, we've given all that up, says Paul, in a culture that prized supremely elegant and clever speaking and paid good money for it. He says we don't need that. Verse 5, he says, we simply set forth the truth plainly and we leave it to God to work out if and when and where he will switch the light on. That is his job. Our job is simply to speak the truth about Jesus, no matter what will happen. Because that's hard enough as it is, right? That in itself is hard enough as it is. But knowing that it's God who saves people is the best motivation to keep going, isn't it? Because it means that even the most unlikely people will get saved. If it's down to God who simply spoke and light came into being at the beginning of creation, let alone everything else that he did, then there is always hope. And I'm sure you know, I hope you know, remarkable stories that happen of people becoming Christians. You just never know. You just never know. The most unlikely people are saved when God switches on the light. So it might be hard, but we keep going. We are, he says, verse 7, like a jar of clay with a great treasure inside. Now the clay jar that Paul refers to here is the first century equivalent of a little plastic bag. All over this area of the Mediterranean, we dig up these small terracotta jars. Usually we dig them up because they're in pieces, they're fragile. People would use them to transport all sorts of things, food and other things and so on, and they were cheap and they were easy to make and they were disposable. They were just thrown away and they would break and you can always get another one. And we, says Paul, we are like that. We are weak and fragile. But God has chosen to use us, we jars of clay, to carry not cheap food or trinkets, but the greatest treasure, the gospel. So as we carry and proclaim the wonderful news about Jesus, we feel as fragile and disposable as those little terracotta jars, the kind of thing you won't let a small child hold because they'll break it. But the gospel we carry is like the most priceless treasure. And the contrast could not be greater. It is bizarre. Can you imagine the queen carrying around the crown jewels in a paper bag? That's the image. But that's what we're like when we share the gospel with people. And the point of all that, says Paul, verse 7, is to show that all the beauty, all the value, all the power of this treasure is in the gospel itself and not in us. So when you get slammed for telling people about Jesus, when we get insulted, when, to use the language of verse 8, we are hard pressed on every side, we are crushed, we are perplexed, we are persecuted, we are struck down and so on. When all of that happens, we are not defeated. Because it wasn't about how well we do and what happens to us. In fact, every time that happens, it makes the good news about Jesus look all the more precious. Because first, it must be amazing that we keep on with it. And more importantly, and this is the main point that Paul makes, the more apparently pathetic and hopeless and useless that we look, we jars of clay, well, the more it becomes clear that God is powerfully at work as we are sustained and as some people become Christians through our apparently weak and pathetic and painful ministry. So Paul is not afraid to call it like it is. We are given over, he says, to death, verse 11. So that Jesus' life can be revealed in us. Our death, the thing we are most afraid of, people giving us a hard time, the rejection, the persecution, our death is what brings life to those around us. We are jars of clay so that the treasure can be seen to be what it really is. And this, of course, is just what it was like for Jesus himself. If we ever doubt the truth of this, we just look again at the cross, don't we? And we are left in no doubt that in the ministry of Jesus, it is always the death of self in so many ways. It's always the death of self that brings life to others. The clay jar of the cross was the vessel for the greatest treasure ever known. Why do we think it would be any different for us? And now, says Paul, we get to share in the same glorious ministry, just as we share in the suffering of the cross. Our ministry is therefore the same shape as that of Jesus. And the reason half the time we don't even start is because we tell ourselves it will not be that way, it will be another way. And so we're surprised when it's hard. Just look at the cross. You cannot be surprised looking at the cross that telling people about Jesus and living for him will be hard. But if we share in the death of Jesus, we also share in his resurrection too. And that's the point of verses 13 to 15. Now, what Paul does now is he quotes from Psalm 116. Psalm 116 is the cry of the man of God who has suffered greatly, but he is still confident in God. We don't have time to look at it in detail now. I encourage you to do that in your own time, but Paul gets right to the heart of it, quoting, "I believed, therefore I have spoken." And the believe word here is the word of trust. He might as well have quoted, "I trusted, therefore I have spoken." And what the psalmist trusts in is the rescue that God brings. And it's quite a rescue. Psalm 116, verse 8, "You, Lord, have delivered me from death." And you don't get a bigger rescue than that. And we, writes Paul, we have the same Spirit of God that caused the psalmist to say those words. And so we speak on the same basis. We speak because we know God's rescued us from death. We speak because we know that God has raised Jesus powerfully from death. And our future life is therefore just as secure as Jesus' own resurrection life. And that's the game changer, isn't it, friends? That's the game changer. See, think back to all that we've considered. Paul, again, he doesn't pull any punches. He does not soften the blow. He doesn't pretend for a moment that Christian ministry, that is, telling people about Jesus, we're all involved in it. He doesn't pretend for a moment that it's not going to be hard. He sums it up, in fact, in one word, death. But he says it is a death in us that God uses to bring life to other people, just as he says the death in he himself brought life to the Corinthians. But it's still a death. And so he reminds us here that death is no problem for Jesus. He overcame it, and he will raise us too on the last day. And all of this, verse 15, he says, for our benefit, so that we will have the joy right here and now as we see more and more people saved. So yes, friends, we just want to be really clear on this. It is hard. You do yourself no favors if you don't get clear about that. It is hard, but then that is what the cross is. It is a death that brings life. It is hard, but then that is what shows where the power is. Our death is what shows the power of life is from God. It is hard, but there is a resurrection to come. There is a life far outweighing the death that we experience now. And so, verse 16, final bookend. We do not lose heart. As we consider these things properly, the troubles that we experience begin, he says, verse 17, to look. Well, look at the language he uses. Light and momentary. And you want to go, hang on, Paul, don't you? Don't you get it? Don't you know how hard it is? Light and momentary, but it's not that he's dismissing what we experience. For goodness sake, he experienced more himself. It's just that he simply calls us to a new perspective, a perspective that looks beyond death and looks beyond the death we experience now to the life that God brings in others, the life that renews us, and the life that is yet to come, which he calls an eternal glory, far outweighing them all. It's just an imbalance. It's light and momentary. So back to my original question. As we do that, as we have this ministry, as we tell people about Jesus, what is the worst that could happen? What's the worst that could happen? What is the lowest possible outcome that we're going to see? Well, if we take 2 Corinthians 4 seriously, then the worst we see that can and will happen is the following. First, people will be saved by the God who made light shine out of darkness. At a minimum, people will be brought from darkness to life. What else? At a minimum, God will be seen to be powerful as he uses us, jars of clay, to carry this great treasure. At a minimum, that is what will happen. And of course, at a minimum, finally, the worst possible outcome for you and me is that we will be raised with Christ to eternal glory. That is the worst that can happen, friends. That's the worst outcome for us. Do you see that? See, that's what Paul needs us to have clear in our heads. That is the worst outcome. It's light and momentary now. That's the minimum outcome from all of this. Yes, there is hardship along the way, but look what life God brings through death. Look at it, says Paul. So when they form the devil's club, when they don't want to be our friend, when our job is at risk, when the jokes are told behind our back, when our family turn away from us or turn us away, and of course when our brothers and sisters in other places face far worse things happening to them, when these things happen, what do we do? Well, we're told very clearly, verse 18, we fix our eyes on the right thing, on what Paul says is unseen and what is yet to come. And when he says unseen, he doesn't mean that, you know, with closed eyes, not aware of it. He says, no, these are things we know for certain what they are. What is unseen is that glorious work of God in bringing people to new life in Jesus. What is unseen is the daily inner renewal of the Christian. And what is unseen is the resurrection of Jesus and our resurrection. And those things are eternal. So it is hard. And I suspect it is only going to get harder. It was hard for Paul. It was hard for Jesus. What else are we expecting? Well, Paul tells us, death. Yet not just death, life. Resurrection life for ourselves and all those that God chooses to make alive through this glorious ministry that we share. Therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart.